And that was Heidi Howe with Food Without a Face. And welcome to Vegetarian Stew, a program to stir up community awareness of our food choices and how these food choices affect our daily lives, our health, the lives of animals, and our environment. Vegetarian Stew stirs together spicy ideas with a dash of common sense and a pinch of creative thinking. We hope that this program simmers in your mind and that you take in some new ideas about food and live more consciously and creatively. I'd like to let our listeners know that the opinions expressed are those of the presenters, not necessarily those of KAFM and its affiliates. And I'm going to ask Joe, hey, Joe, what's cooking?
Oh, hi, Marianne. First of all, before I introduce our guest, I'd like to point out that...
Joe, I think I'm going to point out that you're on a microphone that doesn't have any sound.
There. Oh!
There you go.
Hey, I hope you can hear me now,
yes.
Maria. First of all, I'd like to point out that Earth Day, which is coming up this month, will be celebrated here in Grand Junction on April 19th, which is a Saturday.
That's right.
There's an event at the fairgrounds, and we hope people can come out and have fun and enjoy Earth Day. Usually the past events on Earth Day here in Grand Junction have been a lot of fun with people dancing, and there's music and food and booths and lots of interesting people to meet. So hopefully you can come out to the fairgrounds. There'll be no admission. And join us on April the 19th,
yes.
Saturday.
No charge, and that's Mesa County Fairgrounds, kind of right across from City Market there, from 11 until 5 p.m.
Yep, right out there in Orchard Mesa. So today, hopefully we'll be having a call here soon from New York City. Pamela Rice is calling in from New York City, and she is the author of a popular pamphlet called 101 Reasons Why I'm a Vegetarian, which in 2006 was expanded into a book by the same name. Ms. Rice is also the founder and director of the Vegetarian Center of New York City, which has, since 1999, been the home of the Viva Veggie Society, a nonprofit which she founded and runs. Throughout the 90s, Ms. Rice was the publisher of Viva Vine. A lot of V's here, Marianne. The Vegetarian Issues magazine, and Ms. Rice's most recent project is to organize the upcoming Veggie Pride Parade in New York City. Now, I don't see that the phone is ringing yet, so maybe New York City is, maybe they lost their power there. I don't know.
Who knows? Well, we were just talking about New York City and what a nice place that must be to be vegetarian.
Yeah, there must be a gazillion restaurants where you can go and eat all styles of food. And I'm sure they have a lot of vegetarian and vegan restaurants in New York City, probably on every block. And is New York City yet coming through to us? No, I don't hear her. Well, at any rate, we're going to be talking today about not all of the 101 reasons, because the show is only so long, but we're going to be picking out a few of them and discussing them with our guest. And she's going to explain to us what connection they have with the choice to be a vegetarian or a vegan, and how this choice with your diet can make a difference in global problems, not just a personal decision, but make a real difference. We're going to talk about the loss of aquifers, for example, and we're going to talk about methane, and we're going to talk about hydrogen sulfide emissions. Hopefully this doesn't get your appetite going here.
No, but I think we have Pamela on the line
now. Excellent. Pamela,
Hello?
Are you there?
Yes,
Hello,
we...
this is Pamela Rice.
Hello, Pamela. I just introduced you, and we're glad to have you on the line.
That was nice. I did not hear it.
Well, you'll just have to ask your friends, I guess. And I know that there's some people from New York City listening in today, and we welcome them to a Vegetarian Stew, along with Pamela.
Fantastic, yes.
Hey, Pamela, I've got a couple of questions here. We're going to ask you about your book, The 100 Reasons Why I'm a Vegetarian, and we don't have time for all the 101 reasons, unfortunately, but we are going to pick out a few of them and get into them in specifics. But prior to that, I'm going to set the stage by asking you, what was the criteria that you utilized in selecting these reasons, and what connection do they have with choosing to be a vegetarian or a vegan?
Well, there are a lot of problems with animal agriculture in the world. And my view is it becomes a reason when that problem goes away if everyone were a vegetarian. That's sort of the acid test. The problem simply disappears when people become vegetarian, then the problem becomes what I call a vegetarian issue. Some people may call some of these problems environmental problems or health problems. They may call them something else, but I call them vegetarian problems or vegetarian issues.
Uh-huh. And the problems wouldn't necessarily all disappear, obviously, but I think what you're saying is that the problems would be ameliorated, be improved.
Yes.
The problems would not be so serious problems if people chose to be a vegetarian or a vegan, correct?
Absolutely correct. I mean, a lot of the problems with animal agriculture comes with the pollutants that are emitted from it, also from in terms of the environment, it is depletion of natural resources, and these problems would vastly ameliorate, as you say, would not be nearly as bad if we had in this society a more vegetarian society, or if we had just completely across the board if people did not eat animal products.
Okay, so let's talk about a couple of these reasons in particular and give our listening audience some idea of the connection between these problems that we all face in our lives and in the world and the choice to be a vegetarian or a vegan. I'll pick about five here if we have time, and we'll talk about them. The first one you mentioned, or first one that I picked out in your book, was the concept of dead zones. Now, what are they and what causes them?
Dead zones are vast areas in the water, and usually at coastal areas in the ocean. Closest to home is one of the largest dead zones, and that's down in the Gulf of Mexico. Down the Mississippi River go a lot of what they call nutrients or various runoff chemicals from farming that fuel a lot of algae growth and ultimately depletes the oxygen in the water. And what you end up with is an area where in fact nothing can live. There's virtually no oxygen there, and anything that can swim away will swim toward areas where there is eventually oxygen again, but anything that can't crawl or swim fast enough will die. And now these nutrients or these chemicals, they're coming from further up into, you know, the breadbasket, our great breadbasket in the United States.
The Mississippi River drainage area, essentially.
Yes, the watershed, I guess you might call it, where there's a lot of farming, as we know. But most of that farming, you have to examine what kind of farming is it. It is farming to provide feed for animals. And so here we go. Here is, as far as I'm concerned, a vegetarian issue. We would need vastly less amount of land if that land was going toward some other kind of farming that would feed people directly rather than cycling it through animals.
I see. So based on the concept that it takes 10 pounds of grain to make 1 pound of beef, what you're saying is that all that farming is, so much of that farming is done unnecessarily and inefficiently from the point of view of being a vegetarian.
Yes, you know, people, when they think of farming, they really don't see it as an environmental problem. They see it as something that is inevitable. We can't do anything about it. But that's really false thinking. We could reduce the amount of farming that we do. There's many environmental problems that are caused by farming.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, let's move to another one here, and it's related to farming as well, and that is the threat to aquifers in our country. And out here in Colorado, we have part of the largest aquifer in the country, the Oglala Aquifer, which extends into eastern Colorado. And tell us what happens to aquifers as a result of these farming issues.
Well, they basically deplete. It's you're mining water when you take from an aquifer. And an aquifer, a lot of people think an aquifer is this big rushing amount of water. It's like an ocean or something underneath the water, but it's really more like a sponge. Only recently have we been able to go down there with pumps and actually pull it out. I mean, with technologically, we are now able to get that water out of there like never before, and we've turned basically a desert into a fertile ground up above, across the Midwest. In fact, I didn't know that the Ogallala actually extended all the way to Colorado.
Yeah, into eastern Colorado.
You know, further east, but that's interesting to me.
Well, you know, you're in New York City.
Yeah. Anyway, if you just willy-nilly take this water out of there, future generations will not have that water for themselves. This is a gift, more or less, from the Ice Age. This water, and
it's kind of like a bank
one
account.
One other thing about aquifers that is should be of interest is that they are sort of a geological bulwark against other problems. I mean, when you take water out, that the land actually sinks, and then sometimes. Salt water can get into that aquifer, and there are many problems.
And the aquifer,
you take water out of an aquifer.
The aquifer, I think, a good analogy for the aquifer, it would be kind of like a bank account that was opened up for you as a child, and now you're grown up and you're drawing money out of it like crazy, and it's never going to be replenished.
Absolutely, not until we have another ice age. I mean, if you want to talk about rainfall, it's not replenishing this aquifer, the Ogallala in particular. I mean, farmers are aware of this. You know, I won't say they aren't, and they're trying to manage their water better, and they're probably doing that. But all in all, I mean, the fact that we are growing so much grain to feed to animals so we can eat them, it's just in such vast quantities. You're still going to get in trouble.
Yeah, and also it just takes an awful lot of water to raise animals for food as compared to just raising grain for human consumption. And I think that's the reason that one is in your book as well. How about methane emissions? Where do they come from, and what's the connection with the issues here?
Well, there's methane. There's many different kinds of gases, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide. These are typical gases that emit from something called a lagoon.
It sounds like a nice tropical island you're describing, a lagoon.
Yes, a lagoon. Well, that's a euphemism of the industry. That's what I would say.
Oh.
It is a vast cesspool of animal waste, you know, that is nearby to one of these giant CAFOs. That's another euphemism for
That's a factory farm.
It's a factory farm, and it stands for confined animal feeding operation. But next door to these, you know, what you're doing, you're putting food, you're putting grain into these animals, and out comes, you know, the byproduct, which is manure. And that goes into something massive, gigantic repository of animal waste. From that, you have hydrogen sulfide, which can which is actually explosive and corrosive and methane, which causes global warming, and ammonia, it can travel many hundreds of miles, and it basically can act in the same way that acid rain does. It causes the land and waters many hundreds of miles away often to become acidic. And all of this causes, you know, more algae to grow and more oxygen to be depleted from the water, and for basically the land, the air, and the water to become polluted.
So,
and if we're, you know, you would think, well, how could just one factory farm or something do all this? And it isn't just one factory farm; it's many, and that's the problem.
And so all of these gases are emitted.
In large
quantities as a result of factory farming in one way or another. And methane, I might point out, is emitted from both ends of the cow. Some people don't know that.
It's
part of their
now, methane,
process.
I might mention, there was a great document that came out of the United Nations in the fall of 2006 called Livestock's Long Shadow. People write that down, Google it.
Livestock's
and in there
long
was a 400-page document that essentially one of the most important facts out of there, particularly for people like me who keep up with these things, that in fact, livestock, the world's livestock across the globe, cause in fact more global warming in terms of CO2 emissions or the equivalent of CO2 than all the world's transport vehicles, all the trucks, the cars. And you know, whenever we talk about global warming, we always talk about vehicles, certainly,
and the airplanes. Airplanes are also included in that transportation figure as well.
Thank you very much. Yes, airplanes. Yeah. I mean, this is a lot going on here. Apparently, all the world's transport vehicles and airplanes, they contribute about 13% of all the global warming gases and CO2 equivalent. And but livestock, they cause 18%.
So,
and yet we don't talk about livestock. And again, here's a vegetarian issue as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and not even Al Gore talks about livestock, I've noticed, when he's talking about the threats to of climate change and global warming.
It's an inconvenient truth for him.
Yeah. Take that, Al. Now, recently, you gave a talk in Rochester, I think, entitled Vegetarianism to Save the Planet: Five Reasons You Never Thought Of. Now, Marion and I are intrigued by this because we think we've probably heard many of the reasons, but we're open to be educated here, and we'll take the bait. How would you? What would some of them be, Pamela?
Well, here's a one that I am sure most people don't think of. Again, as a person who thinks about vegetarian issues like myself all the time. When it is the stocking programs for fish across our country, when Europeans came here, there were 16,000, no less, high elevation lakes across our country.
16,000.
16,000 high elevation lakes. And only 5% of them, this is when it was a pristine time, had any fish at all. They were just amphibians and reptiles and things like that. But when the Europeans came, they seeded all of these lakes, nearly all of them, with fish.
Trout.
So that they can be caught. Well, this was the ultimate in invasive species. In fact, it at taxpayer expense all across the country, in state by state. States will stock lakes all across the country.
It's still happening, yes.
It's still going on.
Right.
With fish for anglers. And this is basically, you know, even in protected national parks, they do this. Where
sure.
If there'll be signs all over the place that say, don't even pick a leaf off a tree because it's all, you know, it's a national park.
It's illegal.
You don't want to touch anything.
It's illegal to take a rock home, for example.
I'm sorry, again, please?
It's illegal to pick up a rock in a national park and take that home.
I imagine so. I hadn't thought of that.
It's true.
Yes.
And but I think your point is that it's whereas you can't take a pebble or a rock, you can take these fish, though.
You can go fishing, and in fact, the state government probably stocked the local lake with some kind of fish that is surely non-native. And in fact, one scientist tried to reverse things, tried to bring one lake back to its pristine nature. It was just impossible.
How about another reason?
Yeah, that was a good one, though.
Let's see.
You said five reasons you talked in Rochester
sure.
about. Sure.
So. Let's say drug pollution. Drug pollution.
Drug pollution.
What on earth could that be, right? Well, these big feedlots, usually these giant areas where there's up to, let's say, 100,000, that's actually quite large, but maybe 40,000 cattle in one big feedlot. They go there. There's no grass or anything. The animals live in their own manure for as far as the eye can see. You actually see these places from the air.
You can smell them before you see them, I can tell you that.
You've seen what?
You can smell them before you actually see them.
Good point. Yes, you can, right. You smell them before you see. Well, downstream or down the way, I mean, there will be alongside, there will be these kind of glistening lakes. Well, those aren't really lakes. That's urine and waste from the animals.
Pamela, that's a lagoon, remember?
Right. Anyway, it goes down into the waterways frequently, some of this waste, and it is apparently causing disruption in the sexual characteristics of wildlife.
Ah.
And there have been studies where, in fact, there's almost complete sexual reversal of some species downstream from these places because of the hormones in particular that are implanted in the ears of cattle in particular.
And then there's a lot of antibiotics pumped into the cattle as well.
Right.
And so you have a lot of drugs that are making their way through the cattle into the lagoon, some of it, and into the water systems, into the aquifers and the groundwater and into the streams. And then other animals pick up on that, and it affects
absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely. And when you disrupt the sexual mechanisms of a species in the wild, you are certainly jeopardizing its chances of survival. So there is kind of an interesting, wherever they look, wherever scientists look, they find this. And they're not looking that much. There isn't a whole lot of research dollars that are going into the Europeans are looking into this, and of course they don't want our beef. They don't like hormones in our beef, by the way. So they have, I guess, funded a lot of studies like this.
Uh-huh.
So, I talked about nutrient pollution a bit at the beginning, so that
right.
was another one of my five reasons.
Oh, okay. One more.
Let's see. One. Well, this you don't want to hear about this. I mean, when you're talking about animal agriculture, a lot of times you're talking about subjects that you really really don't want to talk about it.
I know. We talk about things we don't want to talk about all the time.
Animal agriculture. Yeah. And I did mention the problem of dead animals. Dead animals come the modern feedlot, the modern CAFO, confined animal feeding operation, factory farm, if you will. An operator will expect a certain number of the animals to die on a regular basis just from the pretty much abject confinement and horrible conditions that the animals live in such tight confinement and such unnatural conditions. But sometimes there's something called catastrophic mortality. This is another euphemism for you. This is when the number of mortalities, because of a certain situation, let's say weather, electrical breakdown in one of these factory farms, and often animals are indoors. They're not no longer outdoors. They're confined indoors. And these places are must be fed with electricity to run, and when that electrical system sometimes breaks down, and the animals frequently die in great numbers and actually very quickly. You know, weather events, tornadoes, and heat waves, and lots of reasons why animals in animal agriculture will die in great quantities. Well, what do you do with those animals? They become, I mean, it's sad in of itself that a huge number of animals could die like this so suddenly, but it becomes an environmental problem. How do you dispose of all of this literally animal flesh? And, you know, you have problems in every case. If you bury it, you may contaminate the groundwater. If you compost, many people don't compost properly, and so that, again, you contaminate the groundwater. If you incinerate, you've got dioxin in the air.
All right. So those are three, and we're getting short on time. If you would take just a few minutes here, Pamela, and try to sum up and tell us about the Veggie Pride Parade that's coming up in New York City, and also any last thoughts you have for our listeners before we part company with you.
well, great. Thank you so much. Yes, I'm organizing the Veggie Pride Parade in New York City in Greenwich Village. Maybe people have heard of Greenwich Village. It's a progressive
place. Yeah, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a progressive part of town right here in New York City, which is a kind of a progressive city in the country.
Right.
Anyway, so a lot of great progressive thinkers come out of Greenwich Village. So that's exactly. I live one neighborhood over, actually. So I said, that's the place where I want the first Veggie Pride Parade in America. And so we've got a couple of permits. We've got a permit to march through Greenwich Village and into Washington Square Park. We're going to have live music, speakers, exhibitors, and lots of fun events. And folks can go to veggieprideparade.org. VeggiePrideParade.org, and you spell veggie with two G's, V-E-G-G-I-E.
What day is that going to be?
Oh, thank you. May 18, 2008.
All right, so you folks that are in the New York City area and that region, and anyone from Grand Junction that wants to make that trip, that's the day. And you can go to that site and get more information on it. And Pamela, any last thoughts for our listeners before we part with you today?
Well, I hope that I haven't antagonized too many people there in the ranching world. I want to work with farmers. I'm sorry that our country has so catered, so to speak, to animal agriculture, and for a lot of policy reasons, people have gone toward animal agriculture. I would hope that people would go more toward vegetarian agriculture, and I want to work with people and get to the bottom of lots of the problems that animal agriculture causes, and we can go forward and we can make things better.
I think that's great. Education and enlightenment of people about the issues that we talk about is the first step. And then people have the information to make better decisions. We thank you for being our guest today, Pamela.
One final thought.
Oh, go ahead.
Get hip, go veg.
Hey, that sounds like it's right out of Greenwich Village to me. I understand there's a big dead zone off of New York City, too.
I'm sorry, a big what?
A big dead zone off of New York City.
Boy, you got me there. Possibly off,
See?
I think the Long Island.
You're ignoring
Sound
your own backyard there. Okay.
Long thanks. Island Sound is polluted.
thanks, Pamela. Thanks very much for being our guest, and we hope to have you again sometime.
I'm so happy to have had this opportunity.
Thank you, Pamela.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, bye-bye. Thanks, Pam.